Hi, I'm Paul Schaefer.
I'm Will Lee.
And you are watching the Letterman Podcast.
La, 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 la.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Letterman Podcast. My name is Mike Chisholm. I am very excited and happy to present today's episode. Now, before we get to the guest, there's going to be two more episodes. I know we've had a couple little audio issues here. Soundboard issues on my end, the soundboard that I had crapped out. And so there were times where I sounded like a chipmunk. There were times where we had to compensate. And the way we did it was we changed a setting where it sounded like there was a ton of echo on my side. I apologize to Tom Dreesen for that and a couple of the other guests that we had where I wasn't as stellar as I could be from a technical standpoint, which is, you know, par for the course. I'm not a technical guy at all. I'm kind of holding this thing together with popsicle sticks and Elmer's glue. I'm not a technical guy. At one point, you know what? It's going to be really fun at some point if this thing turns into a thing. I mean, it's already a thing, but if it turns into like a bigger thing where there's like, you know, production value into it other than, you know, me buying stuff for, and putting up something in my basement, I would really like to have a place where the technical part of the show can take a gigantic step forward. I think it'll happen at some point, but right now it's okay to kind of be in the Wayne's world of the podcast world, talking about Letterman and company. But that being said, I sound okay right now. And the reason I do is because I'm on this new soundboard. But before, with Andy's episode and with the episode that's coming up next week, Matt Roberts, I sound like I'm in an echo chamber of some sort. Not a social or idealistic echo chamber. I'm talking about a literal chamber where you say something and it sounds echoey. So I apologize for that. Now, that being said, our guest today is fantastic. His name is Andy Carson. You are going to see that Andy Carson and Mike Chisholm are very similar when it comes to their levels of energy, optimism, excitement, gratefulness. All of those things. Andy is, and I want to get the call sign right, he works for Fox 12 in Oregon, has so for well over two decades, KPTV, Fox 12, Oregon. He is on a show called Good Day Oregon. Now, he's a weatherman. He also goes on different adventures in a segment imaginatively titled Andy's Adventures. He has been doing this for a long time, going all around the Pacific Northwest and shooting remotes of interest. This is something that in broadcast TV is a time-honored tradition. It's something I hope that will continue on, these localized, perhaps statewide or countywide programs that focus on their local area. Very, very cool. And Andy does that. But he started as an intern on Late Night with David Letterman. He was actually Paul Schaefer's intern for a couple of cups of coffee. And he has way more of a resume than that when it comes to late night. He actually had a couple of moments similar to what I had with Dave. He had a moment where he was part of the Q&A at late night and had some stuff thrown on the air. So we got a chance to share that feeling with each other. And then there was another time where he showed up there. And well, you know what? I'm going to let Andy tell you, but he had two memorable appearances on late night. I love talking to people who actually got a chance to be on the show and whatnot. And then the stories he told as being Paul's intern, really, really fun stuff. Again, you're really going to appreciate Andy. I know I certainly did. Just really, really excited to present this episode of the Letterman Podcast with Mike Chisholm featuring Andy Carson. Andy, I am so excited that you are here today. It's so much fun to hear some of the staffers from the earlier years and what they've gone on to since then. And people get a kick out of it when they hear it, and we're starting to assemble a community. Andy Carson, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to come on the Letterman Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. I had to, you know, get up from my nap and comb my hair and come down and figure out how to work Zoom. So yeah, it was a pleasure to put that much effort into it.
You figured it out perfectly, and I think you might have one of the classiest backgrounds or classier backgrounds from any of our guests. It's very, very
well,
contemporary.
You can thank Mrs. Carson for that.
How many times do we say that in our lives, right? You can thank Mrs. Chisholm for that. I thank you so much. Before we get going, so Paul Schaefer's assistant back in the day, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to get into that.
Oh, I was the intern to Chris Albers, who was Paul Schaefer's paid assistant. So right. I did it for free.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes, absolutely. And it's funny. We've been on an intern streak lately. We've just had a couple. Matt Larkin just came on and he was part of it later on than you, though. I think he was much further along. I think probably about 10 years further than you were, but I love talking to the interns. The interns have a lot of the great stories. They really, really do. And I love the fact that you and I can talk about this because I'm a huge music fan. And uh-huh. and I just talking about Paul and the band and things like that are something that this show really wants to do. But let's, before we get into that, I want people to know what you've done since then and what you're doing now, because I get a real kick out of it. I love hearing it and seeing it. What do you do now, Andy?
Well, since then, I finished my internship. And I thought about, you know what, I want to work for the show. I want to work for Letterman. I want to do this. And I was on the show a few times for some different things, just had a blast.
Yep.
And Chris Albers, who, as I mentioned earlier, was Paul's assistant, he said, gave me great advice. He said, listen, if you want to be on TV, they're never going to say, Andy, Dave's not feeling well today. Could you fill in for him? And he said, so if you wanted to be on TV, just go do your own thing. So I went back, finished up college. And yep. then I grew up in a small town in Southeast Kansas. Hmm. I went to a college finished my last part of college, graduated from Pittsburgh State University in Pittsburgh, yep. Kansas. Yep. And
What's the team at Pittsburgh?
The Gorillas. State?
The Gorillas.
The Gorillas.
The Fighting Gorillas. Excellent. Yeah. Okay. Yep.
And so there was a CBS affiliate that was like 10 miles south of there that would hire me while I was still in college to do the weather on the weekends.
Perfect.
So I figured Dave did the weather. Yep. I'll do the weather. And yep. then, you know, only he moved on. I worked there doing so I was finishing up college. I was working on Saturday and Sunday nights doing the weather, making yep. $3.35 an hour.
Wow.
And then I, Monday through Friday, I waited tables at Pizza Hut.
Yep.
So I would literally have the times when I would on Sunday night tell people to take shelter. There's a tornado coming and, you know, go save yourself. And the same person on Monday, I could say, do you want extra cheese on that? And, so that's how that evolved. So anyway, I did that weekends for a little bit, and then they started a morning show there. And yeah. my best friend all through college, his name's Toby Cook. We were roommates and stuff like that in college. We hosted a show together, a morning show at that KOAM CBS affiliate. Yep. And then from there, we both ended up going to Lynchburg, Virginia, and did Good Morning Virginia. I was there for about a year and a half, and then I came out to Portland, Oregon. And I've been working on Good Day Oregon. This August, it'll be 27 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good Day Oregon. So give us the format of Good Day Oregon. What are we talking about here?
Well, it used to be on from 6 o'clock in the morning until yep. 9 o'clock in the morning. Yep. But it's evolved. So now Good Day Oregon's on from 4:30 a.m. until 11 a.m.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's forever. But fortunately, they don't make me do that whole time. So my okay. normal schedule is from 6 until 9, and then a break from 9 to 10, and then I go from 10 to 11.
Yep. And what's your role on the show?
I still do the weather, yep. But then I also do a lot of other things. They have a segment called Andy's Adventures, where yep. I'll go pretty much all over the Northwest and do different adventures, from surfing to climbing giant trees to I flew in the Columbia River Gorge in an open cockpit biplane, and it just goes on and on. And so that's really fun. And then I do like live shots. So tomorrow I'm going to be at the St. Paul Rodeo, and I'll be goofing around with the clowns and all that, you know, all that stuff, and then throwing the weather in there as well.
It sounds like you're having a ball. Are you having yeah. a ball?
I am. It's
18
it's
years.
It's just it's such a blast. And I oftentimes look at how impactful just doing that internship with Letterman gave me so much confidence. Because, I mean, I'm just from a small town, 7,000 people. Yep. And it's kind of like, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. And absolutely. So
someone sang a song about that once, I think. I think someone sang a song about that once.
I think so. If not, they should write one.
That's right. We should. We should write it together. I get a tremendous kick out of talking to the staffers because so many of them are from a small town with aspirations that are so gigantic because of the setting they grew up in. They think it is absolutely not possible. But the thing about Letterman and Company all the way along, and don't get me wrong, I mean, there's a bunch of Harvard writers and people who were brought into, don't get me wrong, I understand that. But at the same time, through the entire run of every incarnation of the show, there are people, lots of them, who have extremely similar stories, including right up to Dave himself, you know, being from Indiana and thinking, well, how in the world could this guy, you know, end up in California, end up at the Comedy Store, end up being the successor for Johnny Carson, his mentor, and really in the blueprint of the building of these this franchise, a lot of people who share the same story, some who stayed with it, some who left, got into television in the back end of things, some who came into the front of it, end of it, like you. I love hearing that you were inspired by it. Now let's bring it back. How did you end up with this internship, and what years were we talking about? What years were you at the show?
Can I show a little background before I got to the internship?
Because you can, whatever you like, absolutely.
Kind of a fun story.
Absolutely.
When I was in college, I was taking a theater class and acting class. And this would have been in 1988. Okay. And they had this thing in January where we could go to New York. And this was at this school was in Bolivar, Missouri. We could go to New York, see 10 shows, Broadway shows in 10 days and get 10 hours of credit for it. And
where's the downside in any of this? I don't understand. Yeah, that sounds like the experience of a lifetime.
So I say to my the guy that's going to lead it, the teacher, the professor, I said, can I just go see the Letterman show while I'm there? And he's like, yeah, you can do that. And I'm like, okay, great. How do I get tickets? He goes, oh, they're handing tickets out all the time. They'll just hand out to you. I'm like, sweet. So we go to New York, and first thing I do is I go to 30 Rock, and I go up and I see the first NBC information thing. And I said, I'd like tickets to the Letterman show. And they laugh at me and they said, it's like 2 years in advance. You have to ask for them. And then we send them out and it's a random date. You know, you can't say I need two tickets for this date. And I'm like, ah, you're kidding me. And they said, we do hand out standby tickets.
Yep.
And so I'm like, how does that work? So every morning that they taped that afternoon, I think it was 8 o'clock, they would hand out like 50 standby tickets.
Yep.
So I got there at 6 o'clock in the morning and I was a line, you know, all the way. And so I get like tickets number 36 and 37.
Oh, boy.
I go back that afternoon. No go. I mean, they let like the first eight people in for people that didn't show up.
Yeah.
So the next morning I get there at like 6 and I get tickets 4 and 5. And I go back and no standbys got in. It was packed full. So the next morning I get there like at 4 o'clock in the morning and I'm number one, number two. I've got the first two tickets and I go and I'm standing there and sure enough, I get in. So I'm so excited. I get up, go up the elevator, you know, they're packing us all in. We're in the back, you know, cause it's the standby and I'm sitting there. They come out to warm up the audience for a little bit. And Dave says, are there any questions? I mean, he's there for 90 seconds.
Yep.
And I popped my hand up. Yep. I had no idea what I was going to say. And he said, you up there in the back. And I said, I noticed that you have two chairs down there, but normally just one guest. So could I sit in the other chair? And he goes,
my man, I got to tell you, that is fantastic. You have the opportunity. The pitch comes down the plate and you crank one. And is it going to go foul? Is it going to go over the fence? But you connect. Well done, spur of the moment. Very well done.
Thank you. So then he asked me a few questions. He jokes around a little bit. The music starts for the open. He goes around, comes back out, does a couple of jokes, and a little lull there. And he says to Paul, we got a guy here from Kansas. And Paul's like, yeah, we're really happy to have him. And so the camera goes up there, and I've got a mullet. Okay. And I've got like this bright red shirt and I'm wearing camouflage pants.
Oh,
and I'm just like,
this is great.
Yeah. I'm waving. He's like, where are you from? And he asked me the same questions. I said, Fort Scott. He said, how far away is that? I said, 1500 miles. So he says to somebody on the front row, he said, sir, where are you from? And he said, Long Island. And he said, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to go up there. And he has me come down. So I walk down the stairs and I go up. The guy stands up. I shake his hand, give him a fake kiss, and I sit down. And I'm just sitting there. And it's just, everything is just like, I'm just on cloud nine. Yep. And so he does a couple more jokes and they keep coming back to me because I can see myself up on the monitor. And so
Hal is doing the quick cut to you,
yeah.
The legendary iconic, which has happened to me. There is no feeling like it. I, you know, it's fantastic. You feel like you've arrived,
yes,
when that happens. Yes.
So one of the times it comes back to me and I just look over and put my arm around the guy's wife that I replaced. And so then at the commercial break, the woman, the wife says to me, would you mind to go back up there so I can sit next to my husband? And I'm like, I don't mind at all. This is
you've
like
won.
The greatest moment of my life.
Yeah.
So I go back up there. He comes back down. Well, Wendell at the commercial break is yelling up there and tells me to come back down. And so I come back down and I sit down and I just look at her and I'm like, sorry, and just watch the rest of the show from right there.
Well, Hal's probably like, that's now my go-to for this episode. That's my go-to to cut back to when, Oh,
well, then,
gosh.
So then, fast. So I the show's over. I get a payphone and I call home and I say, hey, mom, tell everybody you know I'm going to be on the Letterman show tonight. And so, it's recorded. So I go back after this whole ordeal and I'm like, it's my picture's in the paper. They've got all this stuff and this is huge deal. And so it was time for me to get a new driver's license.
Yep.
And so it's such a small little town where somebody comes from the DMV to the junior college like twice a month.
Yep.
So I go in there and I'm wearing a Late Night with Dave Letterman sweatshirt.
Yep.
And I want that to be in my picture.
Yep.
And so she's like, it's too low. And so I take it and I hold it up in my chin like that. She takes like five pictures and we pick the best one. So that's in my driver's license photo. So then later that year, a friend of mine and I decide to go to New York. And again, this is from the Midwest. We get out there and no hotel. We sleep in the hallway at Rockefeller, get the standby tickets, and we go back in. And I knew how I was going to get back on the show again. So I'm sitting there and on the way up, I get my driver's license photo out of my wallet. It's in my hand.
Yep.
And Dave comes out, warms up the audience. Any questions? Pop my hand up. And he said, yes, because he had no memory of me from before. Million things go, no memory. And I say, you know, when you go to commercial break and it has something that says Late Night with David Letterman on it, like a subway or whatever, would you use my driver's? Yeah. That guy.
The bumpers.
Yes.
Shout out to Mark Carson, our boy Mark Carson, the Late Night Bumpers. Absolutely. Yep.
He inspired me. So I said, would you use my driver's license photo? And so he's like, well, let me see it. And he gets down there and he just starts laughing and he hands it to somebody in the front row. Music starts. He goes around, comes back out again and does a couple of jokes. And he says, who has Andy's driver's license? And so he gets it and he was clever enough to block out any crucial information.
Yep.
And shows it. But then we banter back and forth for probably 90 seconds on his show. And it was just like, and, you know, one of the things he said is like, where are you staying? And I said, just around. And he's like, $1,000. He's living in that chair right up there. So I think they're going to get me a hotel room. They give me little sponges and the collapsible cup says Late Night with David Letterman. They give me that. The people next to us were so excited that I got that. I bartered some of that to get to go to their hotel and take a shower.
Oh my God.
So then that was all, in 1990. So that was in the late 80s, 1990. Yep. I had been trying to get an internship. I kept sending a resume and then I'd call and they'd say, no, we're booked. Nope, we're books. So finally, I was visiting a friend in Ohio.
Yeah.
And I just thought, a girl that I was dating at the time was a page in D.C. And she says, my aunt and uncle are going to New York. They're opening up a restaurant in Joplin, Missouri, but they're going to get the little things that hold the little sugar packets. They're looking for art. They're looking for all this stuff. And so they're going, I'm going to fly up there and meet them. If you can get yourself to New York, we'll take care of you for the week. And I'm like, great. So I thought, while I'm there, I'll call the Letterman people. So I called and said, hey, I was still in Ohio. And I said, I'm going to be in New York on Friday. I'm hoping to do an internship. You have my resume. Is it okay if I swing by? And they're like, yeah, that's fine. I'm like, okay. So the only way I could time it was an 18-hour Greyhound bus ride overnight.
Yep.
I get to New York on Thursday evening, and I've got like $50.
Yep.
And so I know the whole routine of sleeping in the hallway at Rockefeller. So I go to Hurley's, you know, the restaurant they used to refer to, went there had a dinner, blew through my $50.
Yep.
And then I went up, and it was like 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. I go to that hallway and I sit down. A couple hours later, a couple girls came in and they had an extra pillow. I slept there and got my standby tickets, get up, and I'm like, okay, now I'm going to go to the hotel where we're staying, get freshened up, and go to my interview, which was at 3 o'clock. And side note, we stayed at the Waldorf Astoria.
So, what?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm the only guy in the Greyhound bus that then spent a week at the Waldorf. So I go, and they're like, no, sir, you can't check in until 3 o'clock. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So I sit around in the lobby of the hotel until it gets to be close to time. And then I go, so I'm exhausted. I've ridden on the bus. I need to shave. I've done the best I can with my hair. I did have a sports jacket, and I'm losing my voice. And I go in and I talk to him for like 5 minutes, and they're like, yeah, you'll be fine. When can you start?
Do you remember who you talked to?
I forget the name. Jill mentioned her when she also interned. So you just interviewed Jill not too long ago.
Okay.
Bayer.
Yeah.
It was Colleen Collette, I think.
Yep.
And so it was like super laid back. And they're like, okay, yeah, it's going to start at such and such a time. So
all of that preparation, all that buildup, all of this stuff, and then just the quickest meeting ever.
Yeah. Later, when I'm there, I find out towards the end of our term, they're like, all right, if anybody calls about internships, send them through. Otherwise, tell them we're booked. So it's just it was a timing thing is all it was. And so I think I'm going to be doing, you know, something. I don't even know what I'm going to do, but I'm just excited to be there. And I get there and they're like, you're going to be an assistant to Paul Schaefer and his paid assistant. And I'm like, I know nothing about music. They said, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter. And so I go and I work, and Paul was so gracious. Oh. And so I had friends come out, and he would always meet them and be very kind and talk to them. And then Chris Albers was such a great guy and just a real mentor, so to speak, on certain things. And since then, he's still been very, very nice. So it's been great.
That's excellent. Okay, so I got to ask you, before we kind of get into the job itself, this whirlwind happens. You right now, I believe, I'm a big personal development guy, and I believe that stories like this inspire people to chase dreams, and I love that. I'm doing that by doing the show, Chasing a Dream. I just love it so much. You have a couple brushes with the show. You feel the excitement. You feel the energy. And it just spurs you on. It doesn't detract you. A lot of people, they get satisfied. Okay, well, I had my moment where the camera cut to me. No, you're going to go and do something even more. The driver's license thing, you evolve it that much more. And you keep going and going and going. Young people need to do that. I just, chasing dreams, as far as I'm concerned, is one of those things where you just never know what might happen. And this story is just such a beautiful example of that. You get the gig. How long between they say yes and you start working your first day? What are we talking here for a time frame of prep?
It was probably less than a month.
Okay. So less than a month, you got to figure out a way to get to New York, to have accommodation in New York,
because you're not getting paid,
right?
And to start working at what I imagine would be, is there more of a dream gig that could have been for your young life?
Not,
I mean,
for me, because Dave was really like my main motivation, and in fact, later when I worked in TV, I had an agent, and he said, okay, you don't need to try to do Dave Letterman jokes. You need to do your own stuff, which was great advice, but it was really something that helped me go into that and kind of think outside the box, so to speak, from what other people were doing.
Sure. But also the Letterman enthusiast in you, what a compliment for someone to say something like that, like, oh, that's a Letterman word, or that's a Letterman turn of phrase, or something like that. Because his dialogue is like, I mean, I catch myself all the time saying phrases like, I don't know what that means. I say that all the time to people. Somebody will say something, you know, whatever, and I'll insert that phrase. Of course, that's a Davism, and there's many of them. Yeah. And if somebody calls me on it, I take that as the greatest compliment in the world.
Well, it was funny because, you know, I get in there and I had these other two appearances, and I talked to Chris Albers, and I told him about those appearances, and he goes, you know what? Keep that to yourself, because they'll think you're one of the nut jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's one thing that I was worried about that. I think I'm kind of past it now with the pants people. I'm happy to say we've got a friendly relationship with the pants people here at the Letterman podcast. I'm happy with that. But I was very, very concerned about that at first, because there were, like, I mean, you know, obviously the famous one of the gal who, you know, kept breaking into Dave's house, but yes, a lot of extremely enthusiastic fans that kind of went over the line and weren't excited about it in a professional way and just wanting to be a part of it. But, you know, it was the fanboy versus the, I want to be a part of something here.
Right.
And that's a tough line. I can see why Chris said that to you. Now, that being said, do you have the clips of you on the show?
I do have the driver's license one. Yep. And I can send that to you. And then there were two times that I was on a couple of Dave's remotes, and I've got the clips from that. So I can,
when you're actually working for the show.
When I was working for the show.
But the original one, switching places with the audience member, you don't have that one?
I can't find it. Okay. I can't find it. It's somewhere.
I'll see if we can somehow help you with that.
Yeah. It's on a VHS in a storage room somewhere. I don't know where.
Well, we may have a digital version of it somewhere, and we'll see if we can find that for you. We'll talk about that off air. So you get the gig, you move to New York. Where do you move? Where are you staying? How do you make this work?
I'm just this, you know, boy from the country. I mean, I drive a pickup truck, and subways scared me. I mean, I didn't know how to negotiate all that stuff. And so I found a place in Midtown. So it was just off Broadway, and it was a fairly new apartment complex. And I had a friend that wanted to move to New York as well. So we rented a studio apartment.
Yep.
So there was just one, and we had two air mattresses on the hardwood floor.
Yep.
I kept my clothes in the kitchen cabinets, and he had the closet. And what was kind of fun, it was a nice building, but I mean, it was the absolute cheapest one that they had.
Yeah. And did it have a bathroom?
It did have a bathroom, its own bathroom. Yeah. 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 I mean, there was a concierge, a doorman, all that kind of stuff.
Well,
but I could walk to and from Rockefeller from there. So it was very nice. And a fun side note, Chris Farley also lived in that building.
No kidding.
Yes. Yes. Lived in that building.
Talking 88, 89.
This was 90.
Or
this
90. Was, okay. Was he working for Saturday? He wasn't working for Saturday. Yep. He would have been. Yeah. Would. Of course he would have.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, in fact, after my first week working on Letterman, the interns got invited to the SNL party afterwards. One of the other interns, I don't know who it was, ruined it for us because they went up to, I think it was Rick Ocasek was the guest, and wanted his picture taken with him. And, you know, there's this kind of this invisible line. You don't cross over that.
Yeah.
He went over there to get his picture taken with him and with Rick and his girlfriend. And so that was the last that we got to go to the SNL parties. However, while I was there at the party, Chris Farley comes out on David Spade's back, piggyback, and he's sweating like crazy. And they pass through. So they're on my side now where I can talk. And I go, "Hey, Chris, I hear we live in the same building." And he goes, "Ooh, we should go hot tubbing together." And then went on.
Yeah.
That's yeah.
Great. That's great. I love it. I asked Jill if she ever saw this, because I know that her her office when she worked for Saturday Night Live was how, what a sweetheart Jill is. I just adore her.
Oh, yeah. First of all, Jill, I need to point out Jill, you know, she was Dave's intern, only it was more than an internship. Yeah, it was
absolutely
when I was with Paul. So we were known as the king and queen of the interns.
That's what she said.
Yeah. And we've kept in touch throughout all the years. And thanks to her for connecting us. And then also when Dave had when he retired, she invited me to the retirement party, and I would have never gotten there without Jill. So, I mean, a big, big shout out to her.
She is tremendous. I adore her. And I asked her when she was working for Saturday Night Live, because her office was right near Spade's and Farley's, the legendary stories of Farley wearing Spade's jacket, and, you know, the fat guy had a little jacket, like, I love that. I love that. That's my cast of SNL, the cast you're talking about. They're the ones I was in high school, and I just absolutely adored them. My word, the fact that you had that experience, I mean, 18 years doing what you love, that's great. But I can see you going back into that time and still just, it's a pot of joy that you're just pulling a cup of it out of. I can just see it happening. That is tremendous. You get the, so you know, the small apartment in New York, but you're in Midtown, location. Tell me about the first
day. Actually, Dave's parking garage was on my way to the Rockefeller. So every once in a while, he would park his car and I would follow him, and he would walk and we would just kind of walk through the way to the office. I didn't go up and talk to him because I didn't want to make that kind of thing.
Yeah, didn't want to cross that line. Yeah.
Yep.
First day, like, you go there, can we go back to that? Does any memories of the actual first day itself?
I do remember going in, it was in August. So I was in short sleeves, hot, you know, New York City. And, I go in, and part of my job was, when they would do rehearsal, especially for music rehearsal, I would go into the, studio. Yeah. And I would sit up there with Paul, just so he had his organ and piano and all of his keyboards. And I'd stand there, and if he needed something, I could run go get it for him.
Yeah, so we were on standby. There.
Yeah, and rarely did he need anything. But I would just, so I got to see these performers come in, and they do one practice, and then they would do a camera practice.
Yep.
And what I remember is first day, it was so freaking cold in the studio because Dave wanted it. So, and I'm just like, so, I mean, I brought a coat from there on out. But the specifics of day one, that's the main thing I remember from day one, is just how cold it was and how
cold
got fixed up for that.
That was before they did the crew jackets. The crew jackets is more a CBS thing. There were late night jackets at NBC, but they weren't the institution that they became on CBS. So you're wearing it. You're wearing it. Keeps the comedy fresh is the standard Letterman line. Okay. So you get there, again, it's this stranger in a strange land. Did you take to it quick, or was it like, I guess you had to take to it quick because of the pace, right?
Yeah, I did. And I mean, it was, but it was so much fun because, you know, I was working late morning. So I probably got to work 10 or 11 in the morning. And then I was done after the show finished. Well, actually, after the show was done, we'd go back up to the offices, and sometimes they would book a guest last minute for the next day. And the band would more than likely take off. So I would, Chris would find the song that they were going to do, and then he would record it onto cassette tapes.
Yep.
And I would then get a car, like a town car from that, you know, NBC had, and or that NBC paid for. And I would go to Anton's house and to Will Lee's apartment, and sometimes to Paul Schaefer's place, and take the tapes to him, because there was, you know, no internet. So they couldn't just look it up. So I'd take the tape to him. And I think Sid McGuinness lives so far out that they said, don't worry about it. He'll figure it out.
So wait a second. You hear, I don't know, give me an example. You know, your boy George is coming tomorrow night. We need a copy of Karma Chameleon for everybody. So you can, is that like kind of like that? Is that what we're talking?
Yeah. It was
wow.
Like, that. Yeah. And so then they would just listen to it a few times and then come in and then they would rehearse. And then they'd do the camera rehearsing. And one time Hal Gurney said, hey, Andy, go sit at Dave's desk and introduce the band so that we can do the camera rehearsal. And it was just Hal just being just such a nice guy.
Yeah.
And he said, all right, Andy, we need to do a camera check. Raise your right hand. Raise your left hand. Yep, camera's working. Just like so then they would perform. And then I would take that band back to the sound guy, and he would say, do you like the way it sounds? And they're like, yeah, or a little more of this, a little more of that. And then he'd say, okay. And then he'd switch a button, and it'd be a square little speaker. He said, this is what most people are going to hear. Because that was even before very few people had stereo television.
Absolutely.
So it was like, how does that sound? So that was kind of a fun little thing to do that.
Yeah, there's some very I love talking about this time and when people take the time to talk about the difference in technology at that point. Every show on NBC, you know, they would throw stereo sound on, like it was a big deal.
Yes.
when this happened back then. This is gonna how it's gonna sound on. That is very interesting. So they would adjust the sound because of the band. Like that's something a sound person would do to make sure that it was optimal for as many people as possible.
Yeah. And the sound guy, I wish I remember his name. Super nice. Everybody was happy. He's like, yeah, that sounds good. We're good. And that would be it.
Well, the pleasure of doing the show is the, you know, of course, it's like, I call it like, it's like a family. The Pants Land, it's like a family, right? And, mm-hmm. and with families, I don't know about yours, but with mine, lots of ups and downs, lots of crazy things going on. But at the same time, you know, you take a bullet for each other, and many, if not most of the folks who had extended periods or even you know, brief periods with that family seem to all have some similar similarities in these areas. Okay. So I love this so much. This is so, I love when people, and it seems like almost everybody was the gratefulness that you had to be there.
Yeah.
You know, so you're doing this. I want to know, were you a music, like you didn't know anything about music, but were you like from a technical standpoint, but did you enjoy music?
Oh yeah. I love music.
Okay.
I mean, I would have the radio on and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
But one of the things that I noticed was when these people would come on, and sometimes I had never heard of them,
yes.
but I would see them rehearse and I'm like, okay, there's something more to this person. There's to their performance and what they can do. And I was blown away at the consistency of that and how, you know, it's just like, yep, you deserve to be here. And so that was one of the things that stood out to me. And another thing that stood out to me, all the different musicians that we had on there in the rehearsal, you know, people are walking up and down the side and outside and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
There were two different artists that they stopped in their tracks and came and watched. Steve Vai, remember the guitarist?
Yeah.
If you couldn't hear, just to watch the way he played the guitar, was crazy. People stopped and just like in awe.
A master at work.
And the other one, everybody stopped, Dolly Parton.
Oh, that warms my heart. That delights me so much. Kindness in a little package of blonde and just kind and fun and just delightful. Oh, that's fantastic. I'm curious, did you get introduced to any music that you wouldn't have known beforehand that is still with you today? Is there anything that your heart is kind of attached to?
One of the things that came about was I grew up in a small town in country, so I didn't want to be associated with country music. You know, it was all, because you want to be something else.
Yep.
And Dwight Yoakam came on and he was, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is great. I forget if it was Guitars and Cadillacs or something like that, but it was, you know, one of his classics. And then it was like, okay. And then I started listening to country music. I'm like, you're romanticizing my life. Okay. I like country music. And so that probably is one of the things that brought it in. Another cool thing that Paul Schaefer did one time that the Texas Tornadoes were coming.
Yep.
To perform, and they were playing at a bar the night before, and Paul and Anton were going to it, and Paul knew it was in my neighborhood. And so he said, Annie, come on over, you know, just go tell them you're with me. And so I go to this place, long line. I walk right past it, and I said, I'm here with Paul Schaefer. And they took me right in and took me around, and I sat there. And so that was a tremendous, phenomenal thing.
Oh, man. This is very, very cool hearing some of these things. These are special moments. And I mean, you're talking about them some 30 something years later.
Yeah.
That's tremendous.
Another back to the music a little bit. Yes. I keep bubbling up a story.
Please do. No, this is what the show is all about. Absolutely.
So Paul had gotten married earlier in the year.
Yeah.
And they had a wedding reception later in the year. It was in the fall.
Yeah.
And so he sent out all these RSVPs and then they didn't all get back to them. And so they had me calling different people to see if they were going to come to the reception or not. Brian Doyle Murray was the biggest one I remember calling and left a message. But anyway, I got to go to the wedding reception. And
Paul and Kathy said, really? That's amazing.
Yeah. So I got to go there, and it was at this private club, and they had like go-go girls up in cages that were dancing, and they had the Tower of Power playing, and the Young Rascals.
What?
They were the featured band, and then of course Paul was up there playing with them, as well as Will Lee was playing, and I think Anton was, and then Phoebe Snow. You know Phoebe Snow?
Yeah, I do.
She came in and she did this song that brought the place down. It's one of two legitimate standing ovations to where we won't stop clapping until you sing another song. It's not going to happen. And so she had only planned to do one, and she goes back, and her second song was Rockin' Pneumonia, the Boogie Woogie Flu, and again brought the place down. And I think was within 1 or 2 weeks she was on the show on Letterman performing. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. I love how much Paul loves old show business. You mm-hmm. know, I just adore that. And that sounds like a reception fit for one of the, you know, the greatest band leader that we've ever seen. And, I'm certain that it must tickle you to see what Paul ended up doing outside of Letterman, you know, everything from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to up here in Canada. You know, he's received the Order of Canada. He's a hero up here. And all of that stuff. An absolute genius, but kind, super kind. And that's beautiful. Okay. So I want to just talk for a second. I don't know that we've ever really talked about this on the show so much. Late Night versus Late Show. On Late Night, artists would come into play with the world's most dangerous band mm-hmm. more often than a group would be featuring their latest single, that sort of thing. When it went to Late Show, it was kind of the opposite. Mostly it was groups coming in doing their own thing, and sometimes the band would supplement.
Right.
Did you ever remember any times where there was anybody who didn't jive, or they had a moment to try and fix something because, you know, the artist wasn't playing with their normal band, or were they just so good that didn't happen hardly at all, if at all?
They were so good. I never saw that happen.
Wow.
I did see where Paul, I think it was Iggy Pop.
Yep.
Or somebody like that was on. And yep. he wanted to sing this song, and Paul's like, we can't sing that on TV. We can't, you know, we can't do that on TV. they really did. They just all could work together, and it was unbelievable what they could accomplish in such a short amount of rehearsal. I mean, two times they go through it, and then they're good to go.
Yeah, that is astounding to me. Obviously, you would watch walk-up music rehearsals and things like that as well. Is that something that you'd be seeing?
What was that again?
Walk-up music, like walkout music. Although a lot of the guests that time at Late Night didn't get walkout music, but it was becoming a thing at that point. Would the band be rehearsing other things and
no
comedy?
Okay. No, they would rehearse the the actual thing. I think a lot of times Paul last second would decide what song to play when they came out,
like real time.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was that good. Now, once they would, when the show was about to start, I would go out there and sit with Paul, and they would play as they'd warm up the audience. And so they would play, and then they'd introduce Dave, And then as Dave came out, that was when I exited. I didn't want to, but I had to exit. And then I'd stand out there in the hallway and chat with the pages and the limo drivers. In fact, I became friends with the limo drivers. He's like, Andy, well, we're needing some people to drive on the weekends. You know, you know your way around New York City. I'm like, sure. Yeah, I do. I fortunately decided not to take the stretch limo job, not knowing how to get anywhere in New York besides to my apartment and back.
The guy who's afraid of the subway, not sure how to. Yeah, no, that probably would have resulted in some stories. I just don't know that they would.
Well, wow. I did drive one time when I was in New York, and it was, and you touched a little bit on this when you talked to Jill about she can't drive stick shift.
Yeah.
And so they came to me and it was Lori Diamond, and she's like, Andy, I need you to, you can drive stick shift, right? I'm like, yeah, I can. He's like, okay, Dave's car. And it was a car that NBC leased for him. Okay.
Yep.
So it was a Fiero GT.
Awesome. Yep.
Yeah. And she said there's like the little side light bulb was out. And she said, and the cops love to pull him over. I mean, it's a minor thing, but we've got to get it fixed or they'll. And so she tells me where to go. And she sends me, she has a bag full, a sack full of shirts that say Letterman and hats and all this kind of stuff just to the rim. And she's like, I don't have an appointment, but try to get us in there. And so I drive and I'm in this Fiero and I'm like, all right, I'm going just all out because you kind of have to, one. And two, I figured it's a car that they lease for him. So if there is an incident, he'll probably make fun of it on TV. So,
oh, good for you.
But I didn't want to purposely do something. But
no,
I just,
of course not.
I drove it. And so I get to the garage where she said, and I walk in and there was this woman at the front. And she says, what are you doing here? And I said, I've got Dave Letterman's car here. No, I already told them we don't have any openings. And I'm like, but it's Dave's car and he really needs. No, we're not going to do it. And I said, well, could I speak to the owner? The owner's in a meeting. And I said, that's okay. I'll just wait. And she was just very mad. So I walk around and I'm handing out to the mechanics and everybody shirts and hats and all this kind of stuff. And I call Lori and I'm like, they're not wanting to do it. She goes, well, just wait and see if you can talk to the owner. I'm like, okay. So I'm sitting there. Pretty soon the owner comes walking down the stairs wearing a late night with David Letterman hat. And he said, don't worry, kid, we'll have it ready by 5.
Oh, I love that. And okay. So you and I are like brothers from another mother when it comes to tenacity. I totally 100% believe that. You know, if you want something bad enough, keep going and keep going and keep going as respectfully as you can,
right?
You know, but yes, don't, you know, sometimes taking no for an answer, can be the lead to some really cool stuff not happening. And I love this about you. I can certainly relate, with that boldness. And that is, that's delightful. Dave's Fiero GT. What color was that? Do you remember?
It was red.
It was a red one. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back to you know, the daily grind of what it is that you would do. Lots of sitting there at the beck and call, waiting, listening to music, you know, waiting. Some of the strangest things you've had to do.
Odd. So on Mondays, that's when NBC would, like in the main, when the elevator banks opened up to the late night floor, they'd have all the sodas and stuff like that that they provided. So I would go grab those sodas, as many as I could, and fill the refrigerator in Paul's office. Yep. So we were always stocked. And then Paul always wanted Royal Crown cherry sour things, little candies, little hard candy, and Stimerol chewing gum. So I'd go to the drugstore and I'd buy those. Chris gave me the credit card and I would go get that. And it was just, that was one of the things I did every week. One of the other things is Paul wanted a new like boombox that had a CD player in it because they didn't have that. So they could actually put a CD in and listen to the music there beforehand. And so Chris sends me to this place and it was something like, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but it's 47th Street photo on 52nd Street.
Oh boy.
So it's,
oh, no.
It's you know what I'm talking about?
You're gonna flip it, yeah, or something. Yeah, well, yeah.
It, whichever one it was, yeah, it whatever was, one, yeah. It, the name was on one street, but it was located on another street. And I go there, and it's in, and it's run by Orthodox Jews. And it's you go in there, and there's no like display. You go through this catalog, and you find what you want, and then you take that to a line, and then you pay for it, and then you go down the street to another place where they bring it out to you.
Yep.
And so I go through all of this, and I mean it was they were a bit gruff, you know, and kind of and I wasn't exactly sure what they wanted. So I go through and I get this boom box and I make it back, and Paul's like, it's too big. I can't see anything over it. And so and we've lost the receipt. And
oh, no.
Chris said, you need to take it back and get a smaller one. And I'm like, I don't. So I go back and they're like, no receipt. And I'm like, please. And then I finally said, this was Paul Schaefer's. And they're like, okay. So they switch it out for me and get me a smaller one. But
the Jewish connection strikes again. Thank goodness for that.
Yes.
Okay. So those are some interesting things that you did. Man, I just want to, you were the king and queen of the interns. One of the things that Jill said was that, you know, it was kind of almost like not people that were standoffish to her, but she had to kind of be in the bubble and stay in the bubble with Dave, especially. And I mean, we all know, you know, with Dave's nature, he's so shy and whatnot. I imagine it wouldn't have quite been the same thing for you in your spot, or was it? Was it that you kind of had to be, because Paul was one of the principals of the show?
Oh no, Paul was way more approachable.
Yeah,
I mean, people would come in and talk to Paul all the time. I mean, it was fine. And I'd have friends from out of town, and he would talk to them. I'd introduce them, and he was super, super kind, and just, it was just very easygoing and laid back. So it wasn't that kind of thing. There was one day I did get to hang out with Dave, and it was a remote that we did.
Yep.
And they did this several times. I think it was Phil Sims or Paul Sims.
Paul Sims,
that,
yeah.
Paul Sims, yeah. That it was kind of his thing where Dave starts to do something and he's like, you know what, that's not such a great idea. And then he hangs out with models for the rest of the day. And so this one, it was where they went out and asked little kids what they wanted for Christmas.
Right.
So they had two actors that they had on separately that were little kids, and then they brought me into the shot. And and you know, I had been there, this was at the end of the year, so I hadn't had a haircut the entire time I was there. And just it was kind of, you know, and the wardrobe provided an outfit for me. And we just kind of made it up. Dave made it up. He's like, so what I want you to do is my line was, I go up and Dave's like, what do you want for Christmas? And I'm gonna say, well, the Suzuki 125cc. And then he said, then just stare at the camera for a while and say, is this gonna be on the news? And it was at that point, Dave says, I've got a better idea. And then he goes and hangs out with the models. So we shot this in the morning, and it was in downtown New York. And so I rode with the whole crew, and we go down there. Larry Bud Melman was along. So I got to talk to Calvert DeForest for a while. And so we go down, and we shoot this scene, and then we're done. And they said, all right, that's all we need. And I didn't have cab fare or anything to get back to Midtown. And so I'm like, are you sure you don't need any help with anything? And Hal Gurney goes, yeah, we'll probably use you. Yeah, we just hang out. And so I just hung out. And so then when Dave would go around and do different things, I was just kind of this loner in the background that would kind of be the breakaway point. And they used it a little bit, but then it didn't really evolve that much. But I was in a little bit more. But regardless, I was hanging out with them all day.
So much fun. Yeah.
And so I'm there with Dave and Paul, or with Paul Sims and the different people. And as they're setting stuff up, we're just kind of standing there. Well, we get back to Rockefeller, and they're doing this thing with the models where they're going to put a necklace on Dave.
Yep.
So it was a close up. And Dave goes, Andy, go up to Diamond and get my tooth. And I'm like, what? Just go to Diamond and get my tooth. I'm like, okay. So apparently he had like a tooth that was out. And so I run up there and I say, Lori, Dave needs his tooth. And she's like, okay. And she runs over and she grabs this thing and then the glue and runs it. And I'm in the elevator. And I'm like, funny to say to everybody in the elevator, I've got Dave's tooth right here. So we get down and he's like, thanks. And he puts it back in there and that was it. Well, then later there was an article written by, who were the guys that would critique thumbs up, thumbs down?
Siskel and Ebert.
Yeah. One of them wrote an article about Dave and how he was so busy, he didn't even have time to get his tooth, a missing tooth in there permanently. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's what he's talking about. That's the tooth that I went up and got from Lori and put down there. So
that's the first time that's come up on this show. That's whimsical. That's delightful. I love that story. who were some of the people that you hung out with? Who are some contemporaries that were on the staff that you kind of buddied up with as you had your tenure there?
Well, honestly, I mean, Chris was the main one that I would kind of hang out with on a regular basis. And then Jill. And then beyond that, I mean, I think the interns all got together one time at somebody's place. But I haven't kept up with any of them except for Jill since then.
And she talked about that. She said how you two, like, that's one of the things she said. And that's what I was asking. Like, you know, Paul's more approachable, but you two were kind of isolated from the rest of the pool of interns that ended up sometimes coming on the show or being, you know, get hired on, that kind of a thing. That's what I'm curious about. How long did your internship last?
It went, it was just the fall semester. So from August through December.
So everything that we're talking about here is within a 5-month period, basically.
Right. Wow. Right. So then just to kind of a weird little turn from that. Yeah. After I did that last piece where I was, hanging out with the, this could be on the news.
Yeah.
Jill calls me. I'm back in Kansas. She calls me and she's like, Dave's asking for you. He thought he didn't know I was just an intern and they wanted to use that character as a bit. And I'm like, really? And she's like, yeah. And so I'm like, she's like, get out here. So within 24 hours, I'm back because I had a plane ticket. Back then, it seems like you could only buy a round trip.
Yeah.
And so Southwest, I flew from there back to Kansas. I had the other way. So I just went back up there and I go into the hallway and I get up there and they're like, Dave was asking about you. And they gave it to somebody else. And so it was actually Chris Albers that then took it. And actually Chris did a much better job than I would have done with that character. And so then I'm in New York and I say, okay, so now what? So I stayed there through the spring into early summer just to save up money and then, to get myself back to Kansas and then go on with my life. But that was a little weird piece.
Do you ever miss New York?
I've been back a few times and I do and I don't.
Yep.
You know, there are things about it that are so fun and so exciting. But from there I'm married, three kids.
Yep.
And I think it would have been a challenge to try to do that while I was there. And so I just feel very fortunate where I am. And when I went back out there for the a retirement party, I talked with a lot of people and either they were pretty good fakers or they did remember who I was. Madeline Smithberg was one. Daniel Kellison and Spike Ferris. And I actually talked to Spike a few times when he was doing his late night show on Fox.
Yep.
It was a cross promotion thing. So I talked to Spike there and they were even Biff Henderson talked to Biff at the party. And when I told them what I was doing, they thought that was really cool. They didn't think like, staying in the small time. It wasn't like, well, you didn't make it back to, network, did you? Everybody was really nice about it.
That's the thing. I think that there's a lot of folks there who just have a love of broadcasting, a love of television, I was just talking with Pat Farmer on the phone 45 minutes ago. And we were talking about that. We got kind of lost in talking about some of this stuff that it's the love of the game. Like,
And again, I can see how much you love what you're doing now. And I mean, I live in a very similar area to you. You know, I'm in British Columbia, Canada. I've come down to, you know, your neck of the woods a bunch of times, all sorts of stuff for Twin Peaks things and stuff. You go down, you know, down into Oregon is absolutely beautiful. It's God's country. Like we live the Pacific Northwest, Western Canada, it's absolute God's country. There is this magnet that is New York with all the things that go on in it and whatnot. It seems like you did a pretty good job of scratching the itch and yet still being inspired to stay in television and to move forward, move in front of the camera. We started the conversation talking about things that you learned doing that and how it was kind of the kickoff to a what seems to be a very fun career, Andy. What are some of the things that you learned and that you took with you and that maybe you used to today, every day?
Well, I think part of it was it's, you know, just keep working to get the job done, to no matter how much work it takes, even for a small little thing. Because I remember they did something that required, it was for a tiny, like 10 second punchline, and they drug 1,000 feet of cable all through hallways, stairways, and all that kind of stuff to get it. Yep. And I remember just especially early on in TV when, you know, it was just my co-host and I, and there were just a handful of people, and we had to do all this work. And it was just like, it was worth it. It just to do an amazing amount of stuff just to get one shot, but it can be worth it.
Yeah, that's a fantastic lesson. And certainly, I think that's the thing that one of the things that Letterman's productions right from the beginning did was they would do all sorts of things for what seemed to be a teeny tiny payoff, but you could kind of feel the quality in the bones of the piece, whatever it is, like, wow, they went to a lot of effort to do this. And sometimes that's where the joke was. And sometimes that's just, you know, the getting the job done. That's really cool.
And it can be a small little thing that can be impactful to the viewer. And that can be the thing that sticks out more than anything else.
Yes. I love that. How's the crew that you work with? Is it a similar teamwork mentality? It seems like a lot of television crews that I've run into that do a show for a long period of time have that.
Well, my photographer that I work with, so he's the one that when I go out and do a live shot or I go out and shoot in Andy's Adventures or whatever it is I'm doing, we've only worked together for 25 years, you know, so for well over 20 years. And in fact, I'm going to send you some clips.
Yes.
When I was on the show, I went to him. Do you know where these? And so he finds them. He has it all set up on his computer, even though we didn't know each other. But he's done that. And then what's become weird for me is, you know, being at Letterman, and for the first many, many years in TV, I was the youngest one. And I always had that young look. Well, now I'm older than my bosses, you know, and there's I'm one of the oldest people that are there. And there's, you know, there's a lot of turnover in news and stuff like that. Sure. But there's a certain number of us that have been there for well over 20 years. The guy that does the traffic, he's been there just the same as amount as I have.
Yeah.
That 27 years this August. But then there's other people that come in and out. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of times that we'll get together. And in fact, one of the co-anchors that I work with, she lives just down the street. And she and her husband and my wife and I go to dinner almost every Thursday night.
Oh.
My wife's out of town. She's off at some book club. So her husband and I are going to grab a bite to eat tonight. And then another co-anchor that I work with, she lives out in the country. She's married to a legitimate cowboy. He was in the rodeo circuit for years. And we're all going to the St. Paul Rodeo, and we're all sitting together for the rodeo tomorrow night. And so it's just, you know, there's a lot of stuff where we all get together and do a lot of stuff together.
I love that so much. I can't speak for the rest of America. I love that Oregon has this in some of the networks there. Growing up, my CBS, NBC, ABC affiliates were all from Seattle, and they still are, you know, so those are our affiliates here. And I mean, some of those news teams are still together. And I mean, you know, the person who replaced Gene Anderson is still working for King 5, NBC affiliate in Seattle. Yeah. And I love that, how some of these regional regional groups. It is a family. Just it doesn't matter how big the antenna is. The love of the team and the craft and doing what you're doing. You know, because you guys at the end of the day, you know, time crunches and all of the scheduling and how many things have to come together. You guys are called Foxhole buddies together. You really are. Yeah. And it's Can cool be. To hear that.
One of the neatest stories that I felt from working here for so long is I was at like Home Depot or something and coming out, and this guy comes up to me and introduces himself to me. And he said, I've been watching you since I was a kid, which, you know, that always, but he had gotten into a little bit of trouble and ended up in jail for a short amount of time. Yep. And he was out in Pendleton, Oregon, in jail. And I'm not sure for how long, but he said, I was young and lonely and scared. But they had your show up on the TV in there, and I would watch you, and I would feel connected to my family because we always watched your show every morning. And he said, I'm out. I know I got out. I'm all cleaned up. And he has his own small business. And it was just one of those neat things that you think, you're just this goofball doing the weather and, you know, just messing around on TV. But, you know, in some weird way, you can kind of be people's family members, so to speak.
The connection through the airwaves or through the digital, the ones and zeros now, you know, don't underestimate that. I think that's the reason, you know, that's the reason why we do this show, you know, because there's a group of people that feel such a connection, you know, to that show you were a part of for one semester, but can still articulate it like I can't believe it. You can articulate it like you were there for a decade, and then it took you and inspired you to go in your own direction. I love that. I love this story. How are things in Oregon right now?
Depends on where you go. Yeah. I think they're working on things. It's a work in progress right now. It was a trying time there for a bit, and it's not completely fixed yet, but they're working on it. So
I'm glad to hear that, because it makes you know, national or international. I mean, you know, in Canada, you know, we hear about these things, and it's like, okay, you know, the growing pains of things, unprecedented times. A very interesting time to be in media, and the fact that you have done it for so long, and are continually inspired by it, even during all these crazy different times, unprecedented times that we're in, it's commendable that you can do that. I had asked you, I don't know if you found anything or not, but I asked you if you kept anything from the show, if there were any souvenirs of any sort. Did you end up keeping any souvenirs from your time at Late Night with David Letterman?
I did. Most of it is in storage somewhere, and we've moved. We downsized, the kids moved, and we've moved so many times. But my son is in a rock band, and so I gave him this, and he told me I could go get it. And it's an autographed drum head from Anton Figg.
Fantastic.
Yeah. To Andy, rock on. Anton Figg. Yeah.
So, you know, no offense to Mrs. Carson, but one of those things on the wall could come off pretty easily, and that drum skin could go on there. I think, yeah, there we
see if she notices.
Yeah, there you go. Let's see. I saw Paul a few weeks ago at when I was in New York for Rick's memorial, Rick Sheckman's memorial. Rick Sheckman, just you know, I always, every time I mention his name, the show would not exist if it wasn't for Rick. I appreciate him and his friendship so much. It's the first time I met Paul in the flesh. When I had him on the show, it was like, I thought I was okay. I thought I was great and tight and ready to go. That's how I normally am with these things. I don't get starstruck. Unfortunately, the moment I saw Paul Schaefer's in the waiting room, something happened. It was fine. It was good, but I can't wait for the next time he comes on. When I met him live, the kindness that came out of that guy, and it's not just because we're both Canadian, not just because he'd been on my show, because I watched five people who he had never met before walk up to him after his performance, and the attention that he gave them and the kindness that he gave them, and he tried to make them laugh, and he was just, what a guy. When was the last time you talked to Paul? Was it at the Friars Club there in 15?
Yeah. Okay. It was at the retirement party was the last time.
Okay. Yeah. So that being said, I'm about to send him an email.
Okay.
You know, if you have, I'm going to send him tidings from you, and of course, and let him know that I'm going to send the show to him as well, actually, and let him know that how much you appreciated working with him. I find, I don't know about you, but like the guy who was in prison and came up to you and talked to you, like when we connect with somebody, it's always good for that person to know that we connected with them. If that person mm-hmm. can find that out. And hearing the fact that I think Paul will get quite the kick knowing that you've become what you've become, and we're inspired by, you know, by this show they did in New York City.
I would love that. I would love if you passed that on to him. That would be great. You can give him my number if you want.
Absolutely.
We can call and hang out. If I can throw in one more thing. So I did this small little morning show in Southeast Kansas.
Yep.
And my co-host and I, Toby, they sent us to New York to interview Harry Smith and Mark McEwen. They were doing CBS This Morning.
Wow.
And it was kind of a cross promotion thing to do that. And so
That's great. We went there
and did that. And it was fun. Well, then we're in New York for a little while. And I still had to get in at that point to get past security. You had a little pink card that said NBC across and had your name. Well, it had long expired, but you just open your wallet. They see the top of it. And so we just go on in. And
that's exactly what I would do. That's that boldness I'm talking about. I love that.
We go in and I go right up to the offices and I go in and I see Paul, and I'm wearing a jacket that's from our station. It's KOMB. I was wearing something. I think KOMB was a radio station I worked at. It said that. And he kept saying, comb. What's up with the comb? No, it was KOAM.
comb.
And then we actually went in to the studio when, you know, nothing was going on. And we went in and I got to sit at Dave's desk and Toby sat in the guest chair.
Yep.
And I think it was Biff Henderson took a bunch of pictures for us on the, you know, old school camera.
Oh, that is a fantastic memory. I can't thank you enough for doing this today, Andy.
Oh, thank you. I love to tell my stories. My wife's sick of them. She's heard them so many times. So I get to say that my stories are somebody new.
I know the feeling. Well, you know what? We'll say our goodbye privately. I just want to. You know what? I'll do a quick sponsor plug. We have one sponsor only here at the Letterman Podcast, and that is Rupert G and the Hello Deli. Go to hello-deli.com. You want a late show with David Letterman mug? You want a late show with David Letterman hat? Shirts, Rupert shirts. Get a Rupert shirt while you're there, for God's sakes. The place is for sale. Very soon, the Hello Deli is going to take on a new ownership, and
we should buy it.
That's called professionalism right there, and a callback and attention to detail. That's why you're one of the best in the business. Andy Carson, thank you so much for being on the Letterman Podcast today.
I'll hit stop
and we'll say our goodbye privately. Okay. Wasn't I correct about the similar energy that Andy and I share? Just this wonderful, wonderful guy. I just appreciate so much who he is, his enthusiasm for life and what he does, his gratefulness for being in broadcasting and his role in that. Very, very, very cool talking to him. I'll give you one little footnote. See, many times when these episodes end, when the record button stops, I talk with these people many times, sometimes for like hours after the episode is actually finished, and we just shoot the bull and have a good old time. Andy gave me a little anecdote. I'm not going to say who did it, but this is something that didn't make the episode here, and I just think it's really charming. He told me, so obviously his name is Andy Carson, and maybe some of you might have even asked this question yourself, because people on the staff, as he mentioned, you know, he was in a pretty high profile spot in his spot on the staff being Paul's intern, and so there were people who didn't ask questions that they may have asked if he didn't have that spot of prominence. And one of the questions that that someone came up to him and said to him was, hey, and it was somebody who was actually superior to him, and they said, hey, are you by any chance related to Johnny Carson? And he's not. Now, that being said, this person, when he told him that he was not related to Johnny Carson, the person said, well, there's some people on the staff who think that might be the case,
And maybe you should just keep that fact quiet. I just thought that was absolutely charming that a person named Carson ends up on the Letterman shows in some capacity, and other staff members are like, oh, that's Johnny's, you know, whatever. That's Johnny's nephew from the first marriage or something. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, I just really appreciated that anecdote from him. We've got some great stuff coming up, some great guests I haven't recorded yet. Shot the bull with a couple of very cool, you know, longtime Letterman staffers in the past couple of weeks here, and we're going to do something in the future. Next week's going to be Matt Roberts, the very last head writer for Late Show with David Letterman. Very excited about that. That is an incredible episode. I didn't get to even half of what I wanted to ask him because we just kind of went off on tangents and talked about some amazing things. That episode's coming up next Friday. I just want to say thank you once again to everybody who have been early adopters of this thing. Go to the Facebook group. We're on Threads now. We got a Threads thing. I don't even know how to use it. I barely know how to use the Twitter, but we have that there. The Facebook group is where kind of the most activity is. So search for the Letterman Podcast group on the Facebook. Hello Deli. Hello. Hello-deli.com. Go as soon as you can. Talking to Rupert this week. Stuff is in motion. Not going to say anything else other than that, but the deli is for sale. And stuff is happening right now, and things are being drawn up and terms and all that kind of good stuff, but heartbreaking stuff because, you know, it just feels good knowing the Hello Deli is there in New York City. But that being said, you can go to hello-deli.com and get yourself some Late Show with David Letterman merchandise. That has been another episode of the Letterman Podcast with Mike Chisholm. Coincidentally, I am Mike Chisholm. Thank you, and good night.
Overcoat and underpants.